That's good.
And?
It's character murder.
Ah. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
As you can see, our distinguished guests just met and they're discussing the titles of their books. Joanna, remind us to talk about who picks their titles of the books.
Exactly.
Well, exactly.
I do now.
Oh.
After some rather difficult conversations with the publishers. Yes, exactly.
So, warm welcome to our distinguished guests. As you might have gathered, Joanna Trollope, OBE, Karina Diedrichs-Lichu, and Sophia Kopp. And to all the women who showed up, kijk vir julle, al die gatskop vrouwe, so dis lekker, and all the men. We do like you too, dankie Isaac, ja. As you might maybe gather, I'm not Hanley Boyens. A lot of you know my sister Hanley from her years as a huisgenoot journalist. She's not too well at the moment, so she asked me if I would be kind enough to stand in. And as you know, I used to work in radio for years and television. I've had the wonderful fortune of interviewing many a writer through the years, so this is just going to be a joy. Hanley said I should send her love, and I should tell all of you, as we kick off this discussion on kick-ass heroines, that she has one particular person, literary person, that she wants to thank for her very feminist tendencies. Now, Sophia, you know Hanley.
I know her.
She's a Worcester feminist. And for Hanley, her whole life changed when she met the one and only Pippi Longstocking. I don't know if some of you would agree. In Afrikaans, Pippi's name was translated from the Swedish, Astrid Lindgren's book, Pippi Lotta Provianda Kruisementa Rolgordijna Ephraim's Dochter Langkous. Pippi lived on her own, and she lived on her own terms. She's a hell of a strong, she stood up to bullies, and she had a very, very kind heart. Case in point, this is a quote from one of the Pippi books. I don't think you have a very nice way with ladies, said Pippi. And she lifted him in her strong arms, high in the air, and carried him to a birch tree and hung him over a branch. Then she took the next boy and hung him over another branch. So here we go in the spirit of Pippi and company. Let's meet the guests then. Joanna, we're really thrilled to have you here.
Thank you.
I hear there was a snafu too with your suitcase getting lost.
Anyway, I have it. I'm wearing clean clothes for the first time in quite a long time.
If you did meet a stranger on a train here in South Africa or at the festival, and they say, hi, what do you do? What do you tell people if you've never met them and they don't know what you do for a living?
I say, I'm a writer. And they are completely foxed because most people find it impossible to distinguish between being a writer and being a journalist, particularly the Department of the Army and Defence Ministry in England, who have no idea that people are writers and write books.
That it's a legitimate occupation.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you have written
something? I've been writing since my youngest was 3, and she's now 47. So I've been writing since the dawn of time, since long before any of you were born, I think. Yes, I have been.
Hmm. But surely you've been
particularly
writing before
you.
That. As a child, as a teenager, student?
Well, I grew up before screens, you see. And I think that was really extremely lucky because words were our thing. We all learnt to read. I mean, my sister's in the audience, and I think, you know, we all learnt to read extremely early.
It was the only form of entertainment.
It really was.
Yeah.
Yes.
So,
you know, to read fluently by the age of 5 was not, for my generation, at all exceptional.
No,
everybody did.
I am much older than, and thank you for that. You are my favorite person for the day. But yeah, that it's a problem with the current generation of youngsters is that they have so many choices. They don't have to read.
No, they don't
have to read.
Yeah.
And that the visual is so easy and it's so passive.
Yeah.
So, Joanna wouldn't tell you, but she sold something like nearly 7 million books. I think you've written more than 30 books by now.
I think probably that, yes.
She received an Order of the British Empire from the Queen. Queen, so she's Joanna Trollope O'Keefe.
The Queen was very bored to see me because I wasn't an action man, which is what she really likes. She liked somebody, you know, a boy from the Hong Kong police or something like that.
You should have worn your Superwoman costume.
That's the title of your next book.
Yeah, I suppose it could be. Yes, it could be. Yeah, you're quite right.
The Queen is boring.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
No, I think the Queen is actually rather wonderful. But
yes, she's a tough lady.
Yes, yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
So, Sophia, you've done many a book discussion through the years. Most of our audience will probably know you, but just give us an idea what you've done. You've been a lecturer, you've done a number of interesting things.
I have the most boring life imaginable. I am a language advisor, and I work from home. So my day consists of switching on my computer and then sitting there in my pajamas until 4 o'clock in the afternoon when I take a shower and I put on a clean pair of pajamas, and that's my life. And on Fridays for an hour I go to Pick and Pay and buy some groceries, and that is my life.
But she has written, I think, nearly 15 books, Sophia.
Thereabouts.
And a number of them have received Articafia.
Yeah, but I've written mainly romance novels. This is the first novel that is not romance. This is women's fiction, just feminist women's fiction. I am known for romance novels.
Karina, you were known as a writer of sort of young adult fiction, and your books have been awarded so many prizes, and they've been described as school.
Yes.
So tell us a bit. Joanna was very interested in where you come from.
Yes, well, I come from a young adult background. I sort of started writing almost accidentally. I was involved with a literary magazine and wrote a story, and a publisher contacted me and asked me if I wanted to write a book, and I thought, I'll do it in a weekend. Only a year later, it actually happened. I was humbled, very much so. And yes, so this youth series came to be, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. Because at that stage, I also worked as a publisher. I did children's rights. And then, you know, just life happened, and I went on to other things, and my personal life changed. And just one day in Berlin, I got this idea, started working on it, left it a bit, told my partner, Bertus, who's sitting right over there, about it. And he said, well, start it up again. And I said to him, it can't be done. I can't do it. I don't want to do it. I can't write anymore. You know the story, then you cry and you hug yourself and you drink a lot of wine, because that's sort of the natural process you go through as a writer.
That's the evolution of a manuscript.
And you never know when it's going to hit. But then Bartis said to me, and he sat on me for 2 years. So eventually it was finished, and here it is.
So can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Do you know, I will argue about the drinking a lot of wine and it all being rather hopeless. Somebody once said to me that the question of inspiration is merely spreading the bills out on the kitchen table.
Oh, that would do the trick, yeah. Yeah. Well, I agree.
So I think you've got to approach it perhaps slightly more pragmatically and professionally.
Thank you. So, yes, obviously, you tap into your own personal experiences, and actually a friend of mine is also a writer, said you should never actually write autobiographically in your first couple of books, because then it's out, then it's done. But it's basically about an author, well, she's a poet, she's very enigmatic, she's beautiful, she's dangerous, and she has a falling out with her publisher, and he goes on a bender and he finds her body next to his car. And then the whole story about Anna, that's her name, is told through the experiences during this week of all her various lovers, who they are, why they were in her life, and it all centers around this one evening. So that's basically Karaktermoord in a nutshell.
So, Joanna, your most recent book is?
Is this one about late life marriage called An Unsuitable Match. Because I realize that enormous numbers of people in England, it might not be the case here in South Africa, of my generation were not just falling in love again, they were getting married again.
Here as
and of
well.
Course, and of course, by the time you are in your 60s or 70s, your children are in their 30s and 40s, and they have opinions about this, which they are not
ones.
In the least shy of expressing. So it was time for a novel, because I like reality, which is hence the burden of this song, of this session.
Yes.
Because the reality is, you know, you're a working girl, you're a working woman, and why is that not reflected in the novels we write?
I think it is, though, now. In Afrikaans, there was a, especially in romance novels, there was a very, very strong tradition. When I grew up, the novels that I read in school, when I was supposed to be studying, had a very strong tradition of you fell in love, you got married, and that was the end of your life. Then you became somebody's wife, and that was your life. But that's, I think that has changed. I don't think there is any expectation anymore that you have to write a romance novel where the heroine stops working, you know, stops having a career. That has changed in that genre.
Do you really think so?
In Afrikaans, yes.
It really has.
It really
has. Well, that's
has.
Very advanced of Afrikaans, then.
I think because we live in the country that we live in, where a stay-at-home mom is a very...
It's almost a rarity these days.
Yeah, you get that, but it's the exception, and it's also... You know, you're privileged if you do that. It really is a privilege to be able to do that, or you come from a privileged sort of environment. It is the rule that women work here. Many women in this country are single moms, and working is not a rarity. It's so if you write real fiction where you know you have a heroine that it should be identifiable, you have to write. Somebody who works.
And it gives you more writing material.
Yeah,
exactly. Because the life is bigger.
Yeah, exactly.
So your newest book, Cantlefund, is about a woman who's worked, she's done the right thing, she got married, did a fitting for her husband, and then...
Yeah, the book is about a 50-year-old woman who is the epitome of everything that is traditional and... Afrikaner, and she does everything right. She keeps quiet. She sort of suffers in silence. She is the traditional vloerlap. And then she has a hysterectomy, which is and that's important because in right at the beginning of the book, there is a quote, "Tota mulier in utero," and it is the principle on which womanhood has been decided for. Ages, is that if you have a uterus, you are female. Physiologically, medically, you are a female if you have a uterus. And obviously then, if the uterus is removed during a hysterectomy, what are you? What is that person? Are you still a woman? And how are you supposed to behave? So in the middle of the book, she has the hysterectomy, and that is the tipping point. Because after that, she has the right to define her own womanhood. And, you know, she pays a price for it, but she doesn't.
I would love if we could, just before we get really into this whole kick-ass thing, just quickly read a bit from your books. Would you mind?
Sure.
Sophia, while you...
Okay.
The
first one that
first
you selected.
One, yes.
Okay, let me see if I can actually read my own writing and recall that I've written this. Okay. This is a section that she writes herself. Nelly wrote this herself, so it's in the first person. My ma het my geleer seks is 'n skande. Die kerk het my geleer dis 'n sonde. Flieks het my geleer dis netjies. Storieboeke het my geleer dis fiksie. Betty Friedan het my geleer 'n vrou is 'n denkende deelnemer. Hugh Hefner het my geleer 'n vrou is 'n haas. Die Cosmopolitan het my geleer,
Vleeskleurige onderklere demp 'n man se sekslus. Die World Health Organization se statistiek oor verkrachting het my geleer klere demp niks nie. Jane Austen het my geleer seks word onderlê deur sosiale konvensies. Selma, dis haar onkonvensionele vriendin, het my geleer dis wat jy daarvan maak. Die Italianers het my geleer dis kuns. Die Engelse het my geleer dis plig. My lyf het my geleer dis natuurlik. My siel het my geleer dis 'n geestelike ontwaking. My huwelik het my geleer dis vernietigend.
Now I only understood the proper names in that. I understood Jane Austen,
the World
Betty
Health
Friedan, and
the World Health Organization.
Yes. What have I missed?
Well, you basically got the gist of it.
I did.
What it was about is what sex is.
And, oh, right.
And the different, my mom taught me it was my duty and so on. And at the end, my marriage taught me that it was
devastating.
Yes.
Yeah.
Would you be willing to read us a bit? With you?
Absolutely. Well, I'm afraid this is merely in English.
In one of Chana's books, she refers to Commonwealth English. Am I right? Write about the South African Merlot, the wine.
Yes.
You also write about the people who speak with the accent that we all have, which is the Commonwealth.
What does that mean, that your country was at war at some point with England? Is that Commonwealth English?
Probably,
no, that's the whole world thing.
Well, there's also estuary English, which is no glottal, it's all glottal stops, and it's affected by people who don't wish to sound as if they are in any way elitist, like me. So this is a very casual way of speaking, and it's affected by young men particularly who've been through the English public school system. Now this is a passage of a woman being fired from a private equity firm, and she's being fired by a man, and this is really her enraged response to him firing her. "Stacy," the man said, "I really don't want this to get personal and unpleasant." "It is already," Stacy said. "You can ask a man like you to work a 60-hour week for years on end because most of them don't have the bottom line of family responsibilities. They don't have to think about gender or race much either. It's easier for you, Jeff, isn't it, to replace me with a man who mightn't be half as good as I am than to even try and get your mind round what I'm asking." He had let a beat fall, and then he said, "I'm not talking, Stacy, about replacement."
And so she does lose her job.
She does lose her job. And she goes on to be a much more fulfilled one. This whole book is about four women who work in the finance industry, and I deliberately chose the finance industry because it has long been regarded in England, particularly in the UK, as an exclusively male preserve. And so I thought I'd give my four very clever women the biggest challenge they could possibly have. And then I'm going to read you a passage which is the one gay member of the four quartets, the four women in this book. Beth is, she teaches at a business school in London. She's very influential with new ideas about how business should be run now. And she's been dumped by her long-term lover, who I think is also trying to come back. But she's talking to another member of the quartet, Gabby, who is, she's sort of managing director level in a bank as significant as, say, the Credit Suisse. So a very distinguished woman. but Beth is the lesbian. Beth carried on as if she hadn't spoken. It will be, potentially, the best job I've ever had. I'll be affiliated to all the best business schools in Europe. I'll be building exactly the academic structure I want. I'll be lecturing to the biggest PLCs in Europe about management practices. It's incredible. She paused and then she added, I keep asking myself if that is more important than a good personal life. And if I could only have one of them, personal or professional, which would I choose? And Gabby, I do not know the answer. If you'd asked me a year ago, I'd have opted for work. I thought I was so secure. I thought I was settled. I thought I was made. And then look what happened. And it's thrown me. Gabby stood where she was, her hand on the kettle. Why does it have to be a choice? She said. Why can't we have both? We can. Beth said a little sadly. We just don't seem quite able to. Maybe, Gabby said, we haven't evolved enough. Maybe, Beth said.
Yeah, it's hard.
It is hard. Well, I think this whole idea of having it all is as ludicrous as women not working. Price to pay.
Right, so, Karina, will you read us a bit and then we can think
of... Is this going to be in Afrikaans as well?
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Well, that's really sad.
For you or for us?
No, it's very sad for me.
Christina lê terug en maak haar oë toe. Anna Netling is 'n heks. Elke man wat sy ken, is net daardie vroumens in die tande geskop. Nou sy ook. Maak nie saak dat Anna weg is nie. In elke moontlike scenario trek sy sterker as ooit na vore. Keer sy ongedeerd terug, wonder almal waar sy was en mitologiseer haar verdwyning. Skryf dit toe aan skrywers temperament en almal raap haar volgende crappy boek op. Is sy gewoon weg en bly sy weg, dan word sy ikoon en vir die volgende 30 jaar bespiegel almal oor wat van haar geword het. Het sy al polse gesny, word sy die nuwe Ingrid Jonker. En as iemand die wêreld 'n guns gedoen en haar vermoor het, is dat die onverganklike slagoffer.
So what's interesting about this book is that the sort of the main female character, the femme fatale, is not really in the book, but she is the whole book.
Exactly. Yeah, for me it's interesting that I sometimes feel as a writer you also have to make a choice in how you depict your heroine. And sometimes a really strong woman is almost demonized. So certain attributes, she almost has to be overly sexual, overly aggressive in the business world, or overly this or overly that for her to stand out or to claim a place as a legitimate heroine in a novel. I don't know what your perception is.
I would say that it has been for 2,500 years extremely convenient for women to pick up the slack of society and do the caring and do the supporting and do what they're told. And we are beginning, we're in the middle of the most enormous transition, which I think will go on for generations, between the genders. But I think at last we are beginning to assert ourselves and to show our capacities. Warren Buffett, you know, the sage of Omaha, was asked by some incredibly stupid journalist sometime in the last 6 months. He was asked if there was just one thing to which he attributed his enormous success. And he said rather charmingly he thought the fact that he'd only ever be competing against half the world was quite significant. Mm. And we're good at stuff.
Go ahead.
Joanna, you've been quite sort of vocal about your frustration with the females and the women in romantic fiction. Are you still frustrated?
I think we're slowly getting there. I mean, I would say that a great deal of romantic fiction in English is still very much set in the pre-dramatic world. I mean, Afrikaans sounds to me as if it's extraordinarily advanced in its thinking.
Look, let me not speak on behalf of everybody, and I have not read everything that is out there, but my feeling is that if you write a truly traditional novel nowadays with a truly traditional heroine who wants to sacrifice her life and her career for marriage, it's A, not necessary, and B, not necessarily well received by readers. Afrikaans readers are quite keen and quite willing to accept real women. As I have found with my writing that they're very willing to accept real women living in the real world, dealing with real issues. So you don't have a constraint. There's absolutely no reason for you to write a woman who wants to fall back in a traditional role. If you do, I'm sure there is a place for it, but there's from a publisher or from the reader's point of view, there is no reason for you to write that. It would always be your choice.
It is popularity, isn't it? Because, yeah. You know, as far as the media is concerned in the UK, it is still extraordinarily old-fashioned, I think, in its assumptions.
But we were forced to grow up in a sense, because we had apartheid, we had our writers who actually had to not just wade through creating a literary scene, but to fight a system whilst doing that. And I think it made our female writers stronger. We had some excellent writers like André Pierre Brink, obviously not a female, but he wrote a lot from the almost feminist writing perspective.
Absolutely.
And I think that... It just expedited the whole process for us in Afrikaans, I think.
Yeah, I think that also we had to grow up as a nation.
Yeah.
We deal with real problems in this country. And I became more aware of the fact that in my little white enclave in Pretoria, this is not the only life there is. That there are women in this country living real struggles. And there is a sense of, for me, there is a sense of solidarity there, that giving up a career is really not the biggest issue that you can face in this country. Sending your kids to school with bullets flying over their heads, that is an issue. So we live a different kind of life, and I think which is not to say that we are not coping with the patriarchy. We are, and we're coping with it on many different levels. You know, my frustration is that, and I think I've mentioned it in this book, is that while it is true that we don't have to write traditional novels anymore with traditional women fulfilling traditional roles, the patriarchy is alive and well in this country, and it is sustained mostly by women.
Can I read us something that was in The Guardian last week? I think it was written by Charlotte Higgins, and she said things look different after Me Too. And not just after Me Too, but after several years of a surging fourth wave of feminism. There's been fury against patriarchy, with the term itself, after decades of dormancy, surging back into use to explain everything from the rise of Donald Trump to sexual violence in India to pay inequality in Western Europe, and I mean lots of things here in Africa and South Africa as well. She writes, everywhere dams of silence and fear are bursting as women speak out about wrongs committed by men whose powerful positions once rendered them unassailable. Women have also rewritten the private stories that told themselves or buried about their lives. From family relationships to workplace troubles to sexual encounters, in this atmosphere of revisionism, new stories have been needed. So I guess the question is, do you think Me Too will change the way you write and the way we all write? Karina?
Yes and no. I think it depends on where you stand on that issue. You know, I think it was absolutely necessary and was time that it should have happened, you know. My concern always with something like that is that the pendulum is going to go the other way again. Mm-hmm. So the oppressors become the oppressees, if you like. So for me, I would like to see that there's a balance. So we have this now. We've experienced the evils of the patriarchy almost. Now we have sort of an outlet. But I think as writers, we should try to sort of find a balance between the two. A balance that we don't always see in society. Maybe it's an idealistical idea. But for me, balance is key to everything. And I think that's why our literary scene is looking good, because we've had very much an imbalance, and then we were forced to sort of bring it into sync again. And I think that's why we have the luxury of women writers like Sophia doing absolutely amazing work, whereas 20 years ago, you would have been allowed to write something like that.
I agree, that book of yours, Sophia, flipped word in all.
Yeah, and yeah, I can even swear on a cover. On a cover.
That would never have happened.
There was a lady in Pretoria who came into a bookstore. My friend owns a bookstore, and she has sold many copies of my previous book. The book is called Oorlevingsgids vir 'n Bedonderde Diva. That means it's a survival guide for a screwed diva. And these older ladies would come in and, I want that book about that angry woman. They can't say bedonderde. It's just, they can't get it out. They want to read the book, but they can't say the word. So, yeah, we have come a long way.
And that was one of your most popular books.
Yeah, it's still selling well, yeah.
And do you think this moment that we are living in culturally, could that change?
Look, it will change. Of course it'll change. Life is always an evolution. It shouldn't stay where it is. What worries me a little bit, you've mentioned the fourth wave. I'm never sure in which wave I am. It's sort of like I'm awakening to feminism now at this late stage in my life. I find the older writings very enlightening and so on. I am uncomfortable with the modern take on it. I wrote a scene into this book of a conversation that Nelly had with a group of friends. And during this conversation, she is confronted by a third wave feminist who accuses her of being a traitor because she's straight. She still longs for a man, and she says, I have a son, I have a father, I love these men. My anger is not towards men, it's towards the system. And I wrote this entire scene and the outcome and so on. And after the book was published, I had a life imitating art moment where I attended a gender seminar at a university in Pretoria, where I was told as a writer, you should be writing this kind of novel. You should be creating this kind of woman. And I was foolish enough to put up my hand and say, well, you know, in a historical perspective, if I want to create this kind of figure, then, you know, 100 years ago, women were like this. So if I want to write a woman who is downtrodden and whatever, then I should be able to write her. And I was told emphatically, 100 years ago, there were strong women, and women should not be depicted as victims. And I had this strange, weird awareness that this person, who is a very eminent literary figure from Central Africa with a lot of degrees, a female telling me how I should be writing my characters. This person is doing exactly the same thing that the apartheid government did with with white writers who did not write Afrikaners to their liking.
But that's exactly my point. We should find a balance between the two. Exactly. Because we're being oppressed first by men and now by women. So
exactly. So if
we should find our own voices.
What difference is it if a woman tells me how to be? You know, if I eventually broke free from men telling me how to be and I am in a new dispensation where other women are telling me how to be, what has changed for me? A truly liberated woman is somebody who decides what she wants to be, and if she wants to be conservative and conventional, then that should be her choice. We should be able to have the choice to live the life we choose.
But it's interesting. This weekend I had a discussion with somebody on Facebook who messaged me about the book, and on a public forum she was very upset about it. And she just said it was awful and it was just terrible. And
what upset her?
Everything. She alles waste. So she said basically everything was too much. And then she started private messaging me, and I said to her, what really is upsetting about it? And she said, well, you're demonizing the unarmed gets murdered. And I said, I'm not demonizing her. And she said, well, you are demonizing her because she's very promiscuous, and you know, she drinks a lot, and she doesn't wear underwear, and then dances on tables, and you know, she
how's that demonizing? That's just living your life.
Exactly. So she said it's a dangerous character because firstly it makes women look badly, and secondly now I'm using everything that's wrong with her against her, and so she gets murdered. And I read it a couple of times and I thought, well, I haven't had my glass of bubbly, so it's not the alcohol. I don't understand your argument. So normally I would just leave it, but I had a look, and this woman has got a doctorate. She's in some sort of...
It means nothing.
It means nothing. And no. I said to her, please explain your argument.
A PhD is, yeah. I'm afraid, is
it's
neither...
a piece of paper.
It is.
These days, not even
it
nice
is.
Anymore. And her problem was that either way, I was doing women...
A disservice. Well, only according to her.
Yes, exactly. But that's also a sort of mentality.
But that's social media. That's democratization of opinion.
Yes, and suddenly people get an opinion who really shouldn't have one, or voice it at least. But if you write, you can't shy away from anything. But I think in terms of depicting women, it's sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you create a strong, serious heroine, people are going to have a problem with that. If you try to sort of do it more gently, then people are going to say, why aren't they more out there? Why aren't they stronger? So, and I never hear any conversations that male authors have to have about their male heroines or heroes.
Well, now, in...
Ooh, see, we don't even talk about male heroes. They're just
heroes. Heroes, yeah.
But in the UK, I don't know if it's the case in South Africa, 70% of books bought are bought by women.
Yeah,
I think it's probably more here. It's the figures I've had is that 80%.
No, it's like 82 or something.
80% of books are bought by women.
Joanna, if you write, do you have a reader in mind? Do you write?
No, I don't write for a particular reader, but I would say that my novels have actually chronicled exactly what these two ladies have been talking about, which is the gradual... The gradual evolution of the thinking. So we've got to this place. Because I was at university probably before either of you were born.
No.
I was at university. I went up to university in 1962.
Well, you beat me by 3 years.
So I went on a peace march then, I remember. It was the Cuban Missile Crisis, I remember going on a peace march for.
I've read about that.
Yes, exactly. So it just shows you. So I've really been writing about exactly. I think my novels are a kind of chronicle of the struggles we're going through. And I entirely agree with you. You have to get men on side for this to be worth anything. It's enormous. But we are beginning. We are just beginning. And I think the presence of the populist elected right-wing people around the world, in Europe and in America and so on at the moment, it's the last-ditch scream.
I hope so.
Oh, I think so. I think so. I think we're getting somewhere. Okay. I really do.
So, can we quickly go back and try to remember which heroines, literary heroines, stood out for you that made you want to write other stories?
Well, I mean, Sophia mentioned Jane Austen, and Jane Austen was one. I mean, Jane Austen, if she'd lived at any other time, you have to remember, in the early 19th century, marriage was the only career for a gently born woman. So you married well if you possibly could, and you then Jane Austen accepted a proposal of marriage. The next morning she wrote to Harry Bigwither, who'd proposed to her, and she was very fond of his sister, but she wrote to him and said she'd changed her mind and she couldn't marry him. Because in those days, if you were married, it inevitably meant pregnancy, during which you might die. And when Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility, her two first novels, were delivered to her, she wrote to her sister Cassandra, who was closer to her than anybody, and said, "I have just taken delivery of my darling child." So she would have been, she was on the cusp of making money out of writing when she died of Addison's disease when she was only 40, 41, I think.
You said about Jane Austen, Joanna. I started the project, and you can tell us a little bit about this amazing Jane Austen project you worked on. Joanna wrote, "I started the project thinking Jane Austen was a brilliant novelist. I ended the project believing she was a complete genius, and nothing that has happened since has caused me to revise that."
It hasn't. I mean, you know about, because you're very experienced writing romantic fiction, you know that Jane Austen, how did she know? She was a provincial daughter of a parson in Hampshire in the late 18th, early 19th century. How did she know that this form of romantic fiction, it would involve love, for which you could now say sex, class, power, money, and culture? And those are the three strands, and romantic fiction has been about that forever.
Yeah, but Jane Austen's novels to me, and I am not a literary person at all, I'm a linguist. So I just read a novel and there's a face value, and that's what stays with me. But the thing that sets her novels apart is her social commentary and her amazing ability to look into a society and show you what is going on. And I think that remains with us. Because Mr. Darcy, I mean, we're all in love with Mr. Darcy.
No, we're not. He was very young, and if you know, he was only 23.
I understand.
He was an insufferable pig.
He's a chauvinist.
Colin Firth was Mr. Darcy.
Exactly.
Colin Firth, that scene, Andrew Davis invented that scene. It doesn't exist in Pride and Prejudice.
No, we know, but look, you fall in love with Mr. Darcy when you start reading romance novels, which is like at 11. You don't have any discerning abilities then. But it's only later that you realize that the romance underneath is just the vehicle.
No, it's sex. It's because they all wanted to go to bed together because they're all that age.
Well, it makes the world go round. It still does.
That's why we're here.
Nothing. There's no other reason why we live.
Well, no, it's something you said earlier, that actually women, or at least men and women, are dictated to by their physiology. So it depends what stage you've got to in your life. When you're fertile, you want one thing. When you're postmenopausal, you want something quite different.
Well, I think it depends on how many times you've been disappointed, too. You know, and you sort of
You start out, or I did at least, when I was a youngster, you start out, I've read millions of you know, Harlequin romances, and that's your idea of a relationship. And then you reach my age and you realize that stuff is just paper. And then you know, you look at relationships quite differently and you write a book like this or like Diva.
But why shouldn't that be your physiology that makes you think that?
Are you calling me menopausal?
I would say
I was quite young.
I would say yes, yes, all
it's
kinds
totally
of things.
I mean, you can, from a physiological point of view, be one person, but I mean, if you've been through so much trauma or this or that, that it actually almost changes you to the extent that you are not in sync with, you know, as you said, with what you might want to be physiologically. I don't think so. I think, you know, the human element around you almost steers you into a certain direction, and you don't always have control over that.
But it's, you know, one of the things about kick-ass heroines is that men have known for 2,500 years the validation that work gives you. And we are all, four of us, we are all working women. I should think there's a lot of working women in the audience too. And the satisfaction you get at being good at something is enormous. Yeah, I mean, you're probably a novelist before you're in any kind of relationship, aren't you?
It depends. Does the relationship lead to a book, or the book to a relationship? Yeah, it's difficult to say.
Well, if you took the work away, how would you feel?
The thing is, I've always worn many hats. I've never only just been a writer. So in that sense, I can be, or I am more flexible. But I do need strong relationships around me. I need that creative joining of forces. I've always been in relationships with creative people. My partner of almost 5 years is a winemaker. And it's also
how
a brilliant writer. So that fuels my creativity and my urge to work and to write and to do creative things. Take that away and I feel a bit like a shell. It's not that I need a relationship, I need a particular type of relationship. And to a certain extent, it's a very selfish thing to say, because I need them for me to create this.
No, I would dare to presume that actually your work is more important to you than you're admitting. Because I think that kind of identity is incredibly important to all of us.
No, I will always have my own strong identity. And
the writer Susan Hill, who a lot of you will have read, once said to me, this is about 30 years ago, she said, never let go of your money or your friends, because you never know when you're going to need either.
Well, most,
and she was
both,
quite right.
Both, probably.
Yeah, especially friends.
I think you've mentioned that men have never had to wonder about the importance of their jobs or their careers, or their work. And you know, for me, I have always had to work. I have always been in a position where I had to have a job and a career and keep things going. So I never had the luxury of not knowing
work. Well, financial independence.
Yes. Yeah, so that part of my life is, and I'm in a fortunate position that I love what I do. I love my day job. But I think the layer that a woman has in her life that a man does not necessarily have is that whatever relationships are in your life, whether it's with your kids, with your husband or your partner or your parents or whatever, relationships are your job as well.
Exactly.
And
women don't work the same way.
And if relationships do not work, for some reason, it's always the woman's fault.
Yeah.
If there is something wrong with a child, what kind of mother are you? You know, if there is a problem with a parent, why are you not looking after
your... That's social. That's cultural conditioning, surely.
But of course it is. But the point is, as a woman, no matter how successful your career is, if your child is in trouble, you will be judged as an unsuccessful person. And that brings a layer of stress to women that I don't think men fully understand. And it doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter how successful you are in your career. If your relationship with your parents or with your children are unsatisfactory, then you are not a successful human being. And that is incredibly stressful to live with that sword over your head.
Well, that's also assuming that there are children in the picture, because I get a lot of stress as well because I don't have children. So I'll go to a school and teachers would ask me, why are you writing children's books if you don't have children? Almost, you need a child to be validated as a woman. And
yeah,
also,
exactly.
even it stretches as far as being allowed to write. So, you know, in terms of relationships, children almost makes it much more complicated for women than it would be for men. If a man has children or he doesn't, it doesn't matter when he's a writer. But we sort of have to explain on a creative level why we do certain things where you're a mother or you're not a mother.
I'd like to give the audience a chance to participate if you'd like, but quickly answer me this question. Have you written a kick-ass heroine? If not, do you want to?
Have I?
Yes, is that
I think all my heroines start out as sort of dragging their feet, and by the end of the novel, basically they've kicked their own asses into motion.
Joanna?
Yes.
You have. And you still have some up your sleeve?
Mm-hmm.
Are you writing something now?
Mm-hmm.
I killed mine off on the first page, so I'm going to have to think of another one, but yes. Although I think the best one out there has already been done. Kobi Malan.
Oh, yes. We have this youth series that is called the Master of Stories, sort of a school,
yeah.
You know, the school stories. And it was written by an inimitable, amazing woman called Stella Blakemore, which she has honored in the very smart Karina Dietrich-Sihu, named the publisher in her book.
Blakemore and Blakemore.
and Sophia, who also read the Master of Stories, she actually has a trilogy, and the girls in that trilogy,
Malan.
Their surname is?
Malan. And they live up on the mountain.
Yeah. Kobi Malan and Sophia. Yes, we've been very fortunate to as young readers in South Africa, we've had some amazing literature to read.
Yeah.
Preeminently the most.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, friends in the audience, would anything like to ask any of our writers anything? Just wait, there's the microphone coming your way. Thanks.
Joanna, of all the heroines you've described, who is your absolute favorite?
Heroes?
Heroines.
Oh, heroines. Well, I suppose for entertainment value, I'd have to say Becky Sharp out of Vanity Fair, because the book is quite boring unless Becky's
terrible.
On the page.
Yeah.
Yes, she is. She's wonderful, but in your own books, who?
Oh, I see. Well, they're all of their time. I mean, they're evolving. You know, it might be at a certain stage that I've got to, and I would never put a direct event. You know, I'd never put divorce here, childbirth there. I would never take them out of my own life and put them in a book. But I do hope that everything I've been through informs and enriches the stage I've got to. So I suppose the heroines are all evolving as I do and will. And I would say of the recent heroines, I had rather a soft spot for the older sister in An Unsuitable Match, who was called Prue, and she was a retired headmistress. And she was very, very sensible. And she said to her sister, her younger sister, who was threatening to get married again or want to get married again, it is really, isn't it, just a matter of trust. And she wasn't wrong. So she'd been to the market locally to buy herself some huge, sensible knockoff trainers. She had a kind of attitude to life I rather admire.
Is it also, she tells her sister, you don't have to be married.
Yes, you don't have to. Yeah. No, and you don't have to be.
Yeah. Maybe another question quickly? There at the back.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question.
What is your definition of a heroine?
Well,
somebody who has a sense of purpose and doesn't care about the influences around her.
Also not care what other people say.
Yes.
I would say it's the main character in a book. And in my book, by my standards, that would have to be somebody credible. You might want to shake them. You might be unable to identify with them, but you have to, as far as I'm concerned, believe in their reality. Thank you.
The kind of heroines I create are people who, at the beginning of the book, they are bogged down in some sort of a personal mire, and they become heroines when they climb out of it and they start living a life that they find satisfying.
So they take control.
Yeah, they live a kind of life that makes sense to them. So yes, for some of them it means take control, but I never allow my heroines to fall in love before they are healed, and they become their own women. They find a voice. It is somebody of courage, of integrity, somebody who is willing to live her life honestly.
Okay. Thank you. Why a donkey?
Good question.
Yes, tough one.
Thank you, myself.
Joanna once said, writers aren't there to tell you what to think. They're there to beckon you into a book and join them in thinking.
That's absolutely true.
And the last word, the wonderful Nora Ephron, who wrote some of the best movies.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful.
Nora Ephron said, and this is our message to you today, our parting gift, above all, be the heroine of your life, not the victim.
There you go.
Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.